The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, well, shares of Tesla are higher in the after hours right now as investors continue to digest those first quarter earnings numbers. Global vehicle inventory rose to 28 days. It's a huge jump from the 15 days at the end of last quarter. Shares higher right now by just about 5%. First quarter revenue coming in at $21.3 billion. That was below estimates of $22.3 billion. Also a miss when it comes to EPS, adjusted EPS, I should say, that coming in at 45 cents versus estimates of 52 cents.
Shares of Tesla up about 5.5% in the aftermarket, but also Tesla to accelerate the launch of more affordable models at getting a red sticky by RT here at Bloomberg. All right, so let's get to it with us, Ross Gerber, President and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, and also Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin. Ross out there in Santa Monica, California. Max here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, getting ready for another round of Tesla Bingo, which we'll get into in just a moment. Ross, investors like it. What do you make of this report, looking backwards, looking forwards?
Well, I think the good part of the report, because this is really the only good part of the report, is them saying that they're going to accelerate the production of this next gen vehicle platform. And they were pretty vague about what they're calling this, or, you know, what robotaxi is, or is a Model 2 coming. And I think that'll be clarified on the conference call. So, you know, once again, we don't really watch after hours trading because it really doesn't represent all the participants. And so, and we haven't seen the conference call yet. So we'll see how the stock trades over the next several months. But there really isn't any other good news in that report other than them saying they're going to accelerate production, even though they just fired all the people that are in charge of accelerating production.
Hey, Ross, remind everybody, take a step back here, because Carol and I were looking at the terminal a little earlier. You are a longtime Tesla bull until you weren't, and you were a longtime believer and have been a longtime believer in the company. You guys still own a substantial number of shares over at Gerber Kawasaki, but what is your position right now in Tesla moving forward?
So my position is that Tesla is a wonderful company that has enormous potential with a CEO who has become so divisive that people won't buy the cars. And that's why saying you're just going to produce more cars doesn't address the real issue, is why they're not selling cars today. And that's the issue that needs to be addressed that isn't being addressed. So as a shareholder, we have to assess what the future earnings potential of a company is based off what their business model is. And when we started investing in Tesla over 10 years ago, and we've had a great run up until the purchase of Twitter. And so we've been lowering our position because what we feel is that Elon's behavior has hurt the brand in such a way that consumers actually don't want to buy a Tesla. It's just the best car on the road at the best price. So people buy the car reluctantly at this point. So I think, you know, we've got these problems to solve, and I'm not sure if that will be addressed on the conference call today. And that's, you know, and I don't like being called a Tesla bear, because I actually think they could turn the company around pretty quickly if Elon changed his behavior and stopped attacking everybody. But I just don't think that's going to happen. And so I think the bigger issue that isn't being addressed is, it doesn't matter how many cars Tesla makes if nobody will buy them.
All right. So Max Chafkin, come on in. You guys do the Elon Inc. Podcast. You're constantly looking at what he says, what he does. You're looking at his kind of his assets, his portfolio. Your initial thoughts on kind of the headlines we got?
Yeah,
from the company.
Just to kind of underline, Ross is saying something like this, but like the note about the new products is very vague. It doesn't say we're going to have a Model 2 and it's going to come out on this date, which is what many investors had been hoping for. It sounds like it's saying, if I'm reading it correctly, they're going to try to essentially make the current models more affordable. Now, that obviously could allow them to sell more cars, but it's a slightly different spin on things than what many people have been expecting. The other thing is, as Ross is saying, you know, on a Tesla earnings day, what Elon says, and more importantly, how he says it, is just as important as what's in these numbers. Because he is going to hopefully, anyway, clarify some of this. We'll also hopefully get a sense of like where things stand with robotaxi, where things stand with potential affordable cars. And investors seem to react to based on his optimism. You know, a couple quarters ago when he was in this kind of dour mood, we saw the stock go down. So it's like, do we get an optimistic version of Elon or the kind of very dour, pessimistic Elon?
Well, I wonder if you have a question for Ross, Max.
Yeah, Ross, what is your reading on this paragraph about the product?
Well, I think you're dead right about the two things you just said. Number one, they're of course vague because of the legality of it if they put this down and they don't do it, right? And since nobody seems to know what Elon's going to do, and I'm sure that everybody understands that nobody within Tesla knows what the business plan is either, because they just don't at this point. But I think secondly, a lot of it will be, how does Elon answer these questions from investors during the conference call? And what you said is right. If we have sort of a very positive Elon and he's refocused and he's going to be working at Tesla more, and you know, he can play the room right, maybe we get a little rally in the stock, but it doesn't change the fundamentals. If he doesn't play the room right, this becomes a bloodbath. So, you know, I'm just hoping that he understands the damage that he's done and starts to mitigate this versus diving in and sort of doubling down.
It will be interesting to see if Twitter comes up, or sorry, X comes up, you know, because there is this question and this sense that he spent, gee whiz, a lot of time talking about X, tweeting about X, doing X-related things. There's even a potential, oh, they're going to have a Grok integration inside of the Teslas. And I think that to people who are really bought into the EV story rather than the, you know, Elon Musk genius story, which those are two important constituencies here, I think, for Tesla stock, you know, they would like to see him spend less time on his social media network.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just less time. It's what he's saying. You know, it's like, it's not the time. It's that what he's saying oftentimes is super divisive and basically racist. So it's like, it's really hard to sell products to people when the CEO says things that are really hurtful to people, including me for that matter.
No, and we've talked with you about that. Absolutely. Ross, what could Elon say on the call, or Elon and company say on the call, that would make you more excited about the company, or once again say, you know, kind of, oh, Elon, really?
Well, if I had my dream come true, he'd say, I'm coming back to work at Tesla, because he basically doesn't work at Tesla. And he would say, I'm done tweeting all this garbage in politics. I'm going to really focus on advancing sustainable transportation and energy, and that we're going to release this lower, priced car. And the strategy that we all bought into 3 years ago, you know, and the stock was at all time highs and earnings were going up, you know, 50-100% a year. You know, it was like a different world than today. And it's amazing to me he doesn't understand this difference that really is his responsibility. And so as a shareholder, I have to say it's an extremely distressing time, because the valuation of Tesla is premised off all these great technological innovations, none of which have come to fruition yet. So his focus is 100% what needs to be happening right now.
Hey, Ross, I do want to just end with one last question about the cost of producing these vehicles. It seems like Tesla is doing everything it can to bring down the cost of producing these cars, the cost of goods sold too. What numbers do you want to see there?
Well, they are, but their margins continue to go lower. If you look at the report, which I've only had a minute to look at, you know, their vehicle margins continue to go lower, their operating margins go lower, their net margins go lower.
Yeah.
So they're able to lower the price of the car, but what they're not able to do is keep that going as fast as they're lowering the price of the vehicle. So it's still hurting them, even though they're lowering the cost of the car. and it does it bring in a bigger market, but you're not creating any demand. And this is, I have said it 100 times, every company in America advertises for a reason. People need to know why your products are superior, and all the Tesla people have bought in Teslas, you know? So all these YouTubers can tweet all they want, but everybody who wanted a Tesla bought a Tesla, so you gotta get new customers. And the new customers are being told that charging sucks and EVs are bad and this and that, and Donald Trump says they're bad, and this is all they see all day. And then it's like, why would they go buy a Tesla? Because there's not one ad anywhere that tells you how great the cars are, because they are great.
Right. And you still own them, right? Real quickly, yes or no?
Yeah, yes. I do. I just don't understand why they don't tell people how great their vehicles are.
All right, well, Ross Gerber, so appreciate it. We know you've got to, I think, run over to our TV guys, President and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki. So appreciate you joining us. Max Chafkin is staying with us at Bloomberg Business Week, and we want to roll into the conversation, Ed Ludlow.
Yeah, he's co-host of Bloomberg Technology on Bloomberg TV. He joins us from the San Francisco Bureau. I do want to note, Carol, that Tesla first quarter automotive gross margin, excluding regulatory credits, was at 16.4% for the quarter.
Stock up 6.3% in the aftermarket.
Hey, Ed, come on in here and explain why you think the stock is moving higher, given that a lot of these numbers came in below estimates.
Yeah, I think that the print and the numbers in after hours have nothing to do with the quarter gone. Everyone's looked past it. If frankly, what the shareholder deck outlines is almost line for line exactly what Dana and I outlined in the big take on Sunday, which is on the affordable EV, a big body of work had already been done at the component and production process level. And Tesla is moving forward with a more affordable lineup of EVs based on that technology. It was really misunderstood. It's like the world was banking on the Honda Civic of EVs and Tesla to be the one to bring it. But my understanding from sources, that was never the case. And if you read the shareholder deck, they spell it out pretty clearly. They've looked at this kind of more holistically, and there will be more affordable EVs coming late 2025. Caution, caveat, Musk is also often misses his own deadlines. You know that I always say that. But it's like a something
what?
For everyone. Yeah, you know that. And
just
that was me protecting myself from all the people who may go after me on social media. But explicitly it states that they are working on a purpose-built robo-taxi. And so we went into this saying, if you're a Wall Street institutional giant who really wanted to see an affordable EV, or you're the technology investor or the retail investor that's kind of all in on the Tesla thesis around autonomy, you got that as well. And really, I think the market are joining in hands to play that in after hours.
You know, the question is, like, what is an affordable EV? And I think one of the ways that Elon Musk could clarify is to sort of say that. You know, he, over the weekend, amid all this speculation, he tweeted a screenshot showing the Model Y priced at $29,000, which sounds pretty affordable. Of course, that includes tax credit, which, you know, not everybody gets, and a $5,000 sort of assumption of gas savings. So like, you could imagine a situation where he tries to argue, like, look, we're going to cut a bunch of costs out of this thing, and we're going to make it affordable as is. Like, we don't need an additional model, which is a really intriguing proposal that is a huge, pretty big departure from how the car industry normally does things. And in certain ways, like Ed is saying, maybe not that surprising, right? That's kind of, you know, Elon Musk has long modeled this company after Apple. You know, Apple sells a very, you know, modest product line. All the products kind of look the same. They're all kind of expensive. You know, you could sort of imagine his effort to do this. And I, you know, who knows if it's going to work, but it definitely is outside of what, you know, a normal sort of car company, normal car company analyst would expect to see, would want to see.
You know, guys, I'm looking at a live blog, Corey Cantor weighing in, our BNF electric vehicle analyst, and saying, you know, where he talks about these new models and talks about, I don't know, new models ahead of our previously communicated start of production in the second half of 2025, accelerating that launch. He writes, by including these statements in the investor deck, it shows Tesla has identified that a lack of new models is a problem, but are there actually actions being taken, or just a continued lack of clarity? And I guess, you know, I'm going to go back to you, Max, for a second. It feels like, right, we want a little bit more specifics, right, on what this means.
Yeah, again, it almost, it does have the feel of deck that's being written for maximum optionality. And you know, this is all happening very, very quickly. You know, we've seen Elon Musk get re-engaged, it appears, in any case, you know, conduct this layoff in a way that has seemed, at least according to, you know, the reports that Bloomberg has published, that Ed has written, very hasty. And so you do wonder, like, maybe they are trying to figure this out as we speak, and who knows if we're definitely going to get that level of clarity on the call from Elon Musk. Although, given Elon Musk, like, he cannot help himself but sort of say controversial things. You know, he's got that sort of Trump characteristic of being sort of really, really honest, sometimes to a fault. He may, you know, spout something off that could send the stock in any number of directions.
Ed, to that point, you know, what are you looking for on the call, Ed, if you're when you're tuning into the call?
So I don't want to be inconsistent. You know, I posted in the blog before we kick things off, clarity. But actually, to be fair, I think that Tesla has given us one single line of clarity. So I'm just going to read it. This update may result in achieving less cost reductions than previously expected. So Carol read out the section in which they outlined the explanation. There will be multiple affordable models. But I think that the market, and indeed because Elon Musk kind of guided us there, was thinking this will be a brand new model. Maybe it will be called M2. Maybe it will specifically cost $25,000. I think in that single line of the shareholder deck on page 10, they're saying it will be less expensive than the average cost of a Y or 3 now. It will not be $25,000. And so now we go to the big picture, clarity. How many of these things will you build? And what is the strategy with that vis-a-vis robo-taxi? Because they all occupy the same physical production space in Austin, based on our understanding. I also would think maybe the tone of Elon Musk, Tim, to answer your question.
Yeah.
I thought he'd be a bit combative and frazzled.
Yeah.
Now I just don't know.
Wait, we're surprised by something with Elon? All right, Ed Ludlow, we're going to let you go because we know you've got a full plate to continue. But of course, Bloomberg Technology co-host Ed Ludlow. But we got to talk about, with Max, final minute here or so, Elon Bingo? Tesla
right.
Bingo.
You know, again, I talked about this 3 months ago. This is a thing that many Tesla watchers, bulls, bears, everybody in between, Elon Musk super fans, Elon Musk's haters tend to do, which is to kind of create a bingo card and look for some of his catchphrases. So we at the Elon Inc. podcast, we've got a new episode out right now, and we have this bingo card. Just want to flag a few items. Horse, that would be O1. Now, Elon Musk has said that anyone who's driving a non-autonomous car, not a robotaxi, it'll be like driving a horse compared to a car. So see if he tries that line on us.
Horse drivers out there.
A few others. N2, Grok. N4, reasonably optimistic. He's often reasonably optimistic about lots of things. Lots of fun to be had here, and we'll see if anyone gets bingo.
It's a fun card.
And hopefully we get you back in 3 months and also earlier than 3 months. Be sure to check out the Elon Inc. podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That's Max Chafkin, a columnist for Bloomberg Business Week.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Yeah, there's a lot going on today, right? And as we try to keep you certainly up to date on what's going on in D.C., and it all has to do with the $95 billion in emergency supplemental funding that would be provided, as we've been talking about, for Ukraine, Israel, and also the Indo-Pacific region under that measure working its way right now on the Senate floor. The measure would also require TikTok's Chinese owner to divest the video sharing app, impose sanctions on Iran, and seize Russian assets. So there's a lot of pieces, but the big one really has to do with military aid in particular. particular, almost $61 billion for Ukraine, Tim.
Well, let's get to the interview. Angela Stent is a Russia and foreign policy expert. She's senior fellow at Brookings Institution, also a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council, and who also served in the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State. She's the author of the 2019 book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. She's also professor emerita of government and foreign service at Georgetown. She joins us from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and she's been a go-to throughout the Ukraine-Russian war. So, Angela, good to have you here with us. Ukraine President Zelensky telling NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend that this U.S. support, quote, will really strengthen the armed forces of Ukraine, and that now we would have all the chance to stabilize the situation. From your perspective, how important is this U.S. measure from a financial perspective, military perspective, and also from a show of support perspective?
So I think it's crucially important on all of those counts. This vote has been 6 months in the making. And in those 6 months, the Russians have made gains, particularly in the last few months. And the Ukrainians have literally been running out of ammunition and also air defenses. So what they really need is the artillery and they need the air defenses. And frankly, if this vote had not taken place, and if Ukraine doesn't get the assistance, then I think their prospects would look pretty dim by the end of the year. If this all goes through, they have a fighting chance, if you like, to continue pushing back against the Russians and to do better in this war than they have been doing for the past 6 months.
A fighting chance, but what would you say to critics who say that even with this funding, you're just delaying the inevitable of a Russian win here?
I don't think it's inevitable. Our European allies have also been stepping up and supplying more weapons, and they're financially doing more for Ukraine than we are. European Union with a €50 billion financial instrument just a few months ago, money that they've given to Ukraine. So it's not inevitable. If one believes that at some point there will be a negotiation and there will be, there'll have to be some kind of a settlement over territory. The Ukrainians can still make gains with our assistance. And don't forget, we should never forget, 80% of this money will go to U.S. businesses mm-hmm. and U.S. jobs for people manufacturing those weapons.
Right. We just talked with our Joe Matthew about replenishing the U.S. defense stockpiles that have certainly been coming down mm-hmm. as a result of this support. How is Ukraine doing in this fight? I feel like we've talked to you so many times about kind of where we are. Do we see an ending this year? Do we see an ending anytime soon? I don't know. How do you see it at this point?
Well, so as I said, it's been Ukraine has suffered some reversals right. in the past few months. Russians have taken a bit more territory. The Ukrainians really have a manpower shortage now. So a major challenge for Zelensky is to mobilize more young men. They've lowered the draft age now from 27 to 25. Certainly they can go on fighting this year and into next year. What happens after that really is anyone's guess. It depends also whether there's going to be more U.S. assistance next year, which we don't know about. But the Russians seem to be doing pretty well now, and their economy is on a war footing, and they're just manufacturing weapons at a very high rate. And of course, they're getting drones from Iran, and they're getting ammunition from North Korea. And the Russians do have more men that they can put in this fight than the Ukrainians do.
On the U.S. front, what did you make of the change in position of House leadership, Professor? The idea that that the Speaker was against it until he wasn't.
Right. I think Speaker Johnson listened to a lot of people. We know that he got briefings from the CIA director, William Burns, about just what the situation was actually like and how dire it was for the Ukrainians. He talked to a number of top Republicans, as we know, in the Senate, starting with Mitch McConnell there and the people who were very much in favor of this assistance. He talked to Ukrainian evangelicals, who managed to tell him that what Marjorie Taylor Greene had said about Christians being persecuted in Ukraine is just not true. They gave them. So he talked to a wide variety of other people. And in the end, I think The most important thing maybe was going to Mar-a-Lago and meeting with former President Trump, who himself understood that he didn't really want there to be a Russian victory, particularly if he were then in the White House. And therefore, despite his earlier opposition, President Trump, he was in favor of it, as long as some of it is a loan. And some of this money, I think $9 billion of it, is a loan, but I should say it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly, exactly. How are you thinking about Vladimir Putin at this point and how he could possibly end this war? Does he have to save face? And what his ambitions still are when it comes to his country and its ambitions?
Yeah, well, the Kremlin is furious about the vote in the House, and they're furious about this assistance. We know that there was an emergency meeting in the Kremlin very late at night after after the House passed the bill. I don't think that Putin's ambitions in Ukraine have changed. He still wants Russia to dominate Ukraine, and he still wants there to be regime change in Kyiv. He may understand now that it's going to be much more difficult to do, and he can always tell his people that Russia has been victorious. He could settle for something less than the maximum demands, but that would involve territory that Russia has already taken since February of 2022. He might not be willing to give any of that up. I think until this House vote was passed, the Russians thought that they were really in the home stretch of winning this war. I think now they have to reevaluate that.
But I mean, in terms of ambitions beyond Ukraine, can we think, do you still think that Russian President Vladimir Putin, Angela, might have some ambitions beyond that?
Oh, he no doubt does. I mean, I think the next country would be Moldova, which has a rather fragile political system and where we know that the Russians definitely have ambitions. The Baltic states and Poland are obviously very concerned. I don't think it would be possible for Russia to do another major invasion of a different country anytime soon. But it can also chip away, particularly through the use of disinformation or in the case of Moldova, by supporting and funding pro-Russian parties that will undermine the political system there. But certainly, as long as he's in the Kremlin, I don't think he's going to give up any of these ambitions.
So, you know, we have been speaking to you, Dr. Sten, many times over the last 2+ years about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Given where we are today, what is your realistic view on how it could end? You did say that Putin might not go as far as regime change and actually taking over the entire country. But what's a realistic way for our audience to understand how we could see an end here?
Well, there would be an end to it if both sides, first of all, agree that it's time to negotiate, and neither side agrees on that at the moment. And if the Ukrainian side is willing to accept a territorial settlement that falls short of their maximum goals, which of course is taking back all territory that Russia has occupied since 2014. And if the Russians were willing, if the Kremlin were willing to accept a settlement that, again, falls short of their maximum goals, which is taking over all of Ukraine. But I think what we would see would be much more a ceasefire. It might be a Korean situation where you actually don't have a treaty between the two sides, but you have a de facto ceasefire. But then you would have to have troops, you know, ensuring that the ceasefire isn't broken. And I think the Ukrainians would have to get pretty strong security guarantees from all of the major Western countries to bolster them, to arm them, to try and deter any future Russian invasion.
Angela, how do you think about what happens in the U.S. election, who is ultimately in the White House, and what that means, potentially, if this war is still going on, what it might mean?
Well, so I think if President Biden is reelected, you know, there will be continued support for Ukraine. Will the U.S. be willing to do more? Will it be willing to supply Ukraine with a range of weapons that will actually reach deep into Russian territory? That's a question. If President Trump wins the election, he said that he would end the war quickly. We'll see whether that happens. But I think even if he were instrumental in ending the war, I presume that a Trump administration would want to have a settlement in which Ukraine isn't completely defeated and Russia can say that it won. I'm not sure that that would be in their interest or in the interest of the United States. I'm not sure how they would do that, but I think that would ultimately determine what they do.
That's my question, Dr. Sen. Short of actually using American force, how does the U.S. end a war?
Well, if the Trump administration were to say to Ukraine, okay, we're cutting off all funding, and if the Europeans began to cut off their funding, then of course it would be very difficult for the Ukrainians to continue fighting, although they would fight as long as they could with whatever they had. So that's one scenario, which would be to force them to the negotiating table, but that would take some time too.
Hey, just to recap, everybody, we are, of course, talking with Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. But again, just moments ago, the U.S. Senate has enough votes to advance the $95 billion aid package, providing funding to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The vote to limit debate and move to final passage as soon as today is, though, ongoing. And as we've mentioned, also, there were four pieces, if you will, to this measure. The package includes a measure that would force ByteDance to divest its ownership of TikTok or face a ban here in the United States. But again, as we talked about with Joe Matthew earlier, this is very key in kind of basically putting an end to a lot of the debate that was happening on the floor and moving it along.
So it raises the question for you, Dr. Sten, about if you think that this bill, potential bill, this measure, goes far enough.
I think it goes far enough so far, yes. I mean, if we're going to supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, which we are. I do know that we already have some weapons over the border in Poland. President Biden told President Zelensky on Monday that some of those weapons can get to Ukraine very quickly, as long as he gets the legislation on his desk to sign it. But I think hopefully it's not the last assistance package that there will be for Ukraine.
All right, going to leave it there. As always, keeping us up to date on this and really giving us some perspective, Angela Stent, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, former policy and intelligence official, joining us there from the nation's capital.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, we spent a good portion of our program earlier talking about the sweeping foreign aid package making its way through the Capitol with emergency supplemental funding for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific region. Another part of the measure would also require TikTok's Chinese owner to divest the video sharing app, and that's where we want to go now.
Yeah, we do, and we've got a great roundtable to do it. Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Borinka and Bloomberg Opinion U.S. technology columnist Dave Lee are both here with us. Both of them have been all over this story from the very beginning. Alex joining us out there in our L.A. bureau. Dave is right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Alex, let me start with you. We've been talking so much about this measure making its way through the Senate, through lawmakers. It does have this provision for TikTok and a ban specifically. Let me just go to it. Sanctions, the TikTok sanctions, Russian assets, other language. That's kind of the other fourth chunk of it. Long way, though, before we would see TikTok banned here in the United States.
Certainly, if this bill does get signed into law, which a lot of folks who are watching the progression of it think will happen as soon as this week, there would be about a year for ByteDance to have some kind of separation from TikTok. That is ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese parent company, who under this law would be forced to basically sell its stake. It is a company in a foreign adversary country. China has laws that potentially can allow for data from ByteDance to be seen by the Chinese government. Those are the heart of the concerns from the Senate. But I will tell you, if this law does pass and does force ByteDance to go through some separation, that's not the end of the fight. Our sources familiar with the thinking both at ByteDance and TikTok have said that this is going to head to the courts first before ByteDance will be willing to just easily throw up its hands and say, hey, yeah, sure, we'll get rid of this really valuable asset.
Yeah, when you've got 170 million U.S. users, you don't just walk away from it. Dave, let's bring you into this. Should there even be a fight at all? Because we do wonder about, you know, is the U.S., as you write in your column, you know, a little bit being, you know, hypocritical in terms of the pushback against TikTok. How are you seeing it? How are you thinking about it?
Well, I think one of the big questions about how this entire episode has happened is, you know, the nature of which this has been very, very quickly moved through the process, through the House, through the Senate, as we've just seen today, without much scrutiny of what exactly the concern about TikTok is. Now, there's, you know, there's one framing of the app as being, and I think I described it this way in the piece, as it's like a coiled spring, right? A method by which China, should they ever want to,
right,
be able to sort of exert this extreme influence over many people in America, 170 million users, many of them young users as well that might be receptive to certain messaging. However, we haven't actually seen evidence of that happening. And while we've heard a lot of discussion around how senators and representatives have had these briefings, these kind of behind closed doors briefings, I think it's going to take a little bit more to convince the public that this was a move done for those reasons. And also, as we were just hearing from Alex, you know, this is going to go to the courts. And, mm-hmm. and the question there is going to be, why is this not something that tramples the free speech rights of the users of TikTok? What is the national security argument? Let's see it.
Well, Alex, how would proponents of a bill to ban TikTok in the U.S. respond to what Dave was just talking about? What is the national security argument here?
Like he said, it's been kind of a trust us, it's scary type of argument. You've heard folks say that, oh, the government could get its hands on sensitive user data, things like your name, your address, what you're interested in, where your location is. They also have gone down this path, like Dave was talking about, around influence, saying, hey, well, the Chinese government could influence what these vulnerable young minds could see. But on both sides of those issues, we haven't heard a lot from lawmakers. We've actually heard also from some lawmakers who have been in these closed door briefings who said what they're hearing is really similar to their experience actually on other social media apps who are not owned by a Chinese parent company. As this does go to the courts, I think Dave's question is the right one. When are we going to see the proof and is that the right venue? I will remind you guys, I think we talked about it a month ago when we published the story in Business Week. There was a 1965 Supreme Court case where the U.S. Postal Service was trying to limit Chinese propaganda going mm-hmm. to American users. And SCOTUS actually ruled that Americans have every right to see Chinese propaganda and the government cannot intervene. So depending on kind of which legal battle lands where, there's an expectation that there could be several different arguments that are pushed against this bill if it's signed into law. We might see some onus on the government to sort of justify some of these things, depending on what TikTok or other plaintiffs like creators or merchants, whoever ends up in those legal battles, whatever argument they bring forward, we might need to see some proof for the judicial system to work things out.
Dave, you know, I also do wonder this whole idea. I feel like freedom of speech is just really a big issue we're trying to kind of grapple with in the U.S. with it, or globally, really, in a social media world. Having said that, you know, I'm trying to figure out what the real issue is. Is it that China can just peep into things and have access to the information? As you say, China could save itself a lot of time and effort by buying America's data from the many shady brokers happy to sell it to them. So there's a lot of information already out there. And to be fair, many would argue the U.S. government also is tapping into things and accessing a lot of data on its adversaries.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, one of the parts of this debate that comes up is that, you know, China doesn't allow U.S. apps to become popular.
Proliferate
to become popular in China. So, yeah. You know, there is this sort of back and forth here on this. I argue in the column that, you know, America likes to think it holds itself to a higher standard than China on these kind of things, which is, you know, historically has been true. But, you know, the question of user data, a lot of it comes down to this, the algorithm that TikTok has, mm-hmm. right? This is, you know, the most lucrative algorithm in the world. And it's interesting that even if TikTok was to be sold to a US owner, China has signaled that the algorithm wouldn't be part of that sale. And so the question might then be, well, what value is the app anyway, even if it was to be divested, which, you know, any buyer would be very, very aware of the fact that they weren't getting the secret source of what TikTok is.
Alex, come in on this. Like, I do think we're grappling with this idea of, you know, data, who owns it, who gets access to it, and freedom of information, or not freedom of information, but freedom of speech. Like, help me out in how you're seeing this and how it's kind of working its way through the global tech industry.
Yeah, it's kind of happening both in TikTok's argument, who's saying, look, if we want to protect users, we need to have comprehensive data privacy policy and not just you guys coming after us and fighting on ownership issues. Obviously, the likes of some of TikTok's biggest competitors are not always the friendliest to the idea of new legislation. I'll also point to what I've seen from users. I've been spending a lot of time on TikTok per usual. It is my job. And a lot of folks are really upset that they feel like the government is getting in the way of a place that they feel is very amicable to regular people going viral and talking on the app. TikTok kind of changed the game to that extent. So when it comes down to this kind of freedom of speech argument, I'm also very fascinated to see how people take this bill, if it becomes law, going into the election. Are they looking at who their legislators are, who the president is, Joe Biden, who would be the one signing this, and taking that into account as they sign this bill? And also, does TikTok maybe try to wait until there's a friendlier administration? Donald Trump, the president who signed the first executive order to ban the app, has now since changed his tune, saying the app should probably stay in America, and that those are his feelings these days. So that argument will be one that I'm sure will come up, particularly in the eyes of users and in the eyes of TikTok, who will take this to the courts.
Hey, Dave, I'm wondering in your reporting in the column that you wrote, the idea of this is not necessarily part of the ban, but one thing that I hear from parents all the time is that it's completely addictive. The algorithm serves up content that I don't necessarily want my kid to see all the time. And there are arguments, and I don't know to what extent that these are baseless arguments, about how the Chinese version of TikTok, Douyin, serves different content than what Americans see on the ByteDance TikTok version here in the US.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever actually been backed up by sort of firm data on the differences. Suggestion, yeah, on Douyin, you're getting things about math and science, and whereas on TikTok, you're getting
people love to talk about that.
Jokes. And,
but I have yet to see proof of that.
Yes, same. I mean, I think it's an interesting thought that that could possibly be happening. I think one of the things that is striking to me about how many of the people on TikTok are viewing this, and like Alex, it's my job. That's my excuse I use for using TikTok all the time as well.
All right, 99.9% is for work.
Absolutely.
That 0.1% might be for your own fun and games.
But the reaction is many of them are saying, well, hold on, there's a bill to protect children online that's currently stalled in Congress. There's another bill to put a data privacy law on the books, finally, in America, that seems like a big struggle to get that passed as well. I think many people look at this and say, why is it that this issue, the TikTok issue, has flown through like nothing else, and yet these fundamental laws that could protect users more broadly have just sort of time and time again just slowed right up?
I just want to be compensated for all my data that's helping people. Alex, one last thought, and Dave has this in his story, that it's interesting, you know, we do this all the time. We wonder about the folks in Washington, no disrespect, lawmakers, but whether they really understand it. And Dave, you put in your story a senator asking Mark Zuckerberg, how does Facebook make money? Or when TikTok CEO was asked whether the app connects to home Wi-Fi. So there is this understanding that maybe not everybody understands how it all works. Last 30 seconds. Is that important, like that maybe they're not so up on it, the lawmakers?
Users think it's really important. They think that, again, this is a place where folks have been there to be able to share their mind. And they feel like the government is taking away a place where a lot of the TikTok users feel like they're getting kind of a unvetted, raw view of what's happening in the world. And it's a kind of platform for them to share their thoughts. So certainly those kind of questions turn heads for users of TikTok.
And Facebook makes money by advertising, by the way. And no, you cannot connect it to your home Wi-Fi.
And by selling a few.
Yes, you can.
A few MetaQuest headsets too.
Alex Barranca, Dave Lee, we wanted to do this roundtable. You did it so well. Thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap shortly the Tuesday trade. Having said that, our next guest says large profitable tech companies are beneficiaries of higher interest rates. She goes so far to call them the new defensive companies. And yes, folks, she means companies like Apple, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, and Alphabet. So let's get to it.
We're talking about none other than Nancy Tangler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tangler Investments. Also the author of A Women's Guide to Successful Investing. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So the new defensive, typically when we see rates go up, the large, tech companies, particularly unprofitable tech companies, move lower. But why tech overall? Is it because of just the cash that they have on their balance sheets?
Well, I thank you for that intro.
Yeah, no problem.
You're welcome. I think the secular narrative is a tailwind for these companies, and we're going to hear about that with AI in the coming earnings reports and how much it is impacting earnings. But yeah, I mean, if you look at a company like Meta, their interest earned on cash went up threefold. Yeah. Google went up 78%, and the leader in this pack,
that's real money.
It's real money, and the leader in this pack is Microsoft, which had a blowout second quarter last year and has continued to accumulate cash. And then you sort of add to that the fact that nobody can get, you know, any M&A through this FTC. I think you're going to start to see some return of capital to shareholders.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I feel like there's momentum, I think, courtesy of you. I think Abigail Doolittle.
That's what I was thinking when I asked the question. Our own Abigail Doolittle, chief markets correspondent, mentioned this a couple of weeks ago about the cash that these companies have on hand and the way it's generating money.
Well, in a higher rate environment, yeah. That means something, right? And so they're not as problematic. You're a smaller company in a higher rate environment. You don't have that access to cash so easily because you probably are going to need to tap debt markets, if you will. These guys don't. They're actually okay. All right, having said that, then how do you think about, you know, do you buy them when there's a little bit of a pullback? What's the role in the portfolio? Do you buy all of them? How do you think about it?
Yeah, I don't think you buy all of them, Carol. But I will say this. We were trimming the names in February. We didn't know the market was going to peak in March. And we're pretty disciplined in that regard.
Yeah.
When things get overweighted, we trim. I mean, I can make an argument
just
that
an overweighted should, call that you would trim back.
Yeah, okay. And or valuation. But I could make a case, and as I do in my book, that you probably should never trim. I mean, all the great wealth has come from one stock in a founder's portfolio. But that's what we do as professional money managers. We've been back in adding to some of the names after this pullback, correction, whatever you want to call it, because I do think that they're well positioned, and it goes back to our analogy of the 90s. You know, we have so many similarities, ex-globalization to the 1990s, and I think the most important of that is productivity. And like old economy company Raytheon reported today, they're going to report $200 million in productivity improvements this year. And a lot of that is because they're digitizing their factories and connecting them. That stuff really matters, and it's going to be what drives earnings growth. And we think that's the only thing that matters, and the Fed matters a lot less.
Which stocks are you buying right now? Are you adding?
We've been adding to names like Oracle. We will be adding to Lam after they report, because it's been pretty disappointing in the chip space.
Why wait until after they report?
Just because we think there's probably a little bit more room to the downside, and it gives you clarity. But we're in many of these names at such much lower levels. We've added to Microsoft. We've added to Google pretty significantly. And when you ask me this question, it's like in my head. Oh, and Adobe we've been adding to on the weakness, and Palo Alto Networks, which sold off 28% after the last earnings report.
Don't hear Tesla.
We will be.
You will be.
Well, what level?
Yes.
Talk to us about this.
Okay, so... I mean, it's not the stock and Spotify, by the way, it's not the stock I really want to defend, but you know, this is a CEO who thrives in chaos. And the last time that it was this bad, the company didn't even have earnings. I bought the stock at 180.
Did you buy Spotify? Going.
Finish
on Tesla.
Carol.
I know. I know. Focus. Go ahead.
We bought it about 180 pre-splits.
Tesla.
And then, yes. And then he was smoking pot on the Joe Rogan show, drinking whiskey. People were quitting. The board
Ford was just super not independent. He was sleeping on the factory floor. You remember,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We sold it. Like, I felt like it was gambling.
Every
it was
move
investing.
We've documented.
Yeah. So I took a double, and the stock's up 555% since then, including the recent pullback. So we added to the stock a year ago. We reinitiated it at about $104 a share. We sold some when it got in the 200s. We bought a little bit too soon at 180. And at current levels, we think a lot of the bad news is priced in. And the last thing I'll say about it, it's only trading as an EV company, but the really interesting part of the business is the utility grade battery pack business, which is growing 50% a year and will dwarf the EV business at about $120 billion in market valuation in about 5 years.
Is there anything that comes off of the earnings tonight that would make you, I don't know, either buy, sell, or do something?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
I don't think you don't sound like you're very reactionary that way.
No, I don't think Elon Musk could say anything that would surprise me.
Okay.
If by chance Donald Trump gets invested, I think he will no longer, Elon that is, be the man that everyone should hate. And we'll go back to parsing the tweets of another well-known, outspoken. Yeah.
I want to go back to Spotify. Surging today, swing to profit, boost in paid subscribers. You know, WOA, I forgot to do this as one of my gainers today, but it's up about 13%. Was up as much
not
as 17%.
Late,
when were you guys buying it?
We bought in the high 80s. And this was a plan based on
today
the fact,
at 306.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, we sometimes get them right. We don't always get them right.
Yeah.
But and we were just, you know, we were convinced that they had a lot of room to raise prices. They'd held the business, you know, they were able to grow it. This notion where they went out and made it a more open format so you can get the Joe Rogan podcast on other platforms, that was brilliant. That was a pivot. And I think that the management team should be commended. Now they've been able to stick a couple of price increases. Because they waited so long, I think it is even more impactful, as opposed to some of the names, the consumer names that came out today. They're still raising prices. You know, okay, EPS is up, but volumes are down. At some point, that party comes to an end.
What are you staying away from?
For the moment, we are underweight REITs. We're underweight utilities.
Are you tapping treasuries at all with the move up in rates?
Where are you?
So
personally, this is the first time I've ever owned a treasury in my entire life.
Wow.
We've been putting clients in short ladders, and we just started to extend duration a couple of weeks ago.
How far out?
Two.
Okay.
We're not going very far out because we think there's an opportunity to morph into munis and corporates when the treasury short game is done. And so that's, we've just been rolling these short ladders and it's worked out pretty well.
What? I've been interrupted way too much.
We love it when you join us, Nancy.
No, it's really...
Especially in person.
Just 20 seconds. I mean, does it feel like things are going to be okay? Well, you hesitated.
Carol, I think the economy's slowing somewhat.
Okay.
Industrial names have not performed well. You got the S&P Global PMIs today. Manufacturing has gone from expansionary to contractionary. And the labor market is softening, I think.
I feel like there's that tone. Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, I think that's
but
good,
I'm not
though,
sorry to
because I think that'll let the Fed off the hook.
Nancy Tangler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Of Laffer Tangler.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern.
On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.